Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Of all the parties and all the parades and the storied history of New Orleans, today could see one of the grandest. The New Orleans Saints Super Bowl victory parade smack dab in the middle of Mardi Gras season. Rolling across Bourbon Street, it doesn't get bigger than that. We haven't seen New Orleans smile this much since before Hurricane Katrina, 5 years ago this August. There's a new mayor-elect with the Super Bowl buzz, new hope, and a pile of issues still along the levees. This hour On Point, we're checking in on the joy and challenge of New Orleans. You can join the conversation. What have you seen in the City of the Saints? What and how much has come back from Katrina? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Saints fans were out in the streets Sunday night celebrating their team's 31-17 victory over the Indianapolis Colts with the city's signature "Who Dat" chant. And here is Saints quarterback Drew Brees speaking after his Super Bowl victory on Sunday night. Brees won the MVP award, said the team had a bigger cause in its quest than just a championship.
All season long, and really over the last 4 years that I've been in New Orleans, that most of us have been in New Orleans, we played for so much more than just ourselves. We played for our city. We played for the entire Gulf Coast region. We played for all the entire Who Dat Nation who was behind us.
The entire Who Dat Nation. We took this show to New Orleans in 2007 to broadcast from the shores of Lake Pontchartrain. It is good to check in again at a happy time. Stephanie Grace is with us, columnist for the Times-Picayune, joins us from New Orleans today to help us look at the state of the city now. Stephanie, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, how are you?
Great. And Jason Berry, writer, investigative reporter, and city historian, is here. He's author of Up from the Cradle of Jazz and a New Orleans novel, Last of the Red Hot Papas. Jason Berry, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you both with us. Stephanie, my goodness, your paper was just over the moon here. It meant so much more than football. The Times-Picayune said it meant victory for a recovering city that in some places still bears the dirty waterlines of Katrina, victory for people who lived 2 years in trailers, victory for new post-Katrina friends who fell in love with New Orleans, rebuilding it, victory for New Orleanians cheering in exile from Alaska to Miami, and right on down. You say this is a city, you write, Stephanie, that not only feels good, but feels good about feeling good right now.
Absolutely. I've never been through anything like it, and it's topped upon them. It's everybody you see. It's white, black, rich, poor, suburb, city. You know, these lines that usually divide us and our politicians sometimes use to divide us. You cannot divide the city this weekend.
Jason, give us a sense of the feeling in the streets there over these past, 48 hours now?
Well, I'm chagrined to say that I have not been in the streets as much as I would have preferred.
Get out there, New Orleanian!
Well, I'm going to the parade tonight for the Saints, I can assure you of that. But, you know, just to give you one small example echoing what Stephanie just said, I was at Mass Sunday morning, and a young girl, I guess 14, 15 years old, a young lady, read at the pulpit, you know, the offertory prayers, mm-hmm. and we prayed for peace in Iraq, we prayed for the Pope, and then she said, and we pray for the New Orleans Saints to come through the Super Bowl injury-free and to win.
Dear Lord.
I hesitate to go out on a long limb, but I think prayers like that were going on all over town.
We do not doubt it. We're so glad to have the two of you with us from New Orleans. We've got one more guest we want to bring in here right now, special to us. Tom Watson is here, senior pastor at Watson Memorial Teaching Ministries, son of the city, roots going back generations. He's run for mayor, worked in city government, and he shared his insights with us when On Point came to town back in 07. Pastor Watson, Tom, it's great to have you with us again.
Hello, it's good to be on the air. It's good to be engaged in such a healthy discussion about our beloved city.
Tell us what you think this big victory has meant so far. And we haven't even got to the mayoral election yet, but just a football victory in a Coliseum in Miami means what for New Orleans, Tom?
Well, I think it means though people 4 years ago wrote us off, and I'm speaking generally now, there were those of us like the New Orleans Saints who came back, engaged ourselves. I got back here the first Sunday of November and reopened my church. I was one of the first pastors back on the ground in November 05. We had a very, very remnant of our people. Mm-hmm. But, of course, our doors were open for the entire city, so we had a true spirit of togetherness and ecumenical spirit and the like. And so as we now fast forward and we have a football team that has excited us and enthused us and engaged us, it is my hope that that same enthusiasm and engagement will transcend into something long-lasting. My biggest concern is that we get excited for the moment, we party for the moment, we really, really know how to do that well. We have it down to an art and a science,
yeah,
in terms of our party spirit. And so not to damper anything, not to be pessimistic at all, but to say, you know, particularly as a pastor, one who looks, you know, way beyond the event and the moment, I pray. It's really my prayer, just as I heard one of your persons talking about, mm-hmm, the young lady or young person, mm-hmm, that prayed at Mass. It's my prayer that kind of spirit will be long-lasting. And I know it may be wishful thinking, if you will, but I believe with the right people at the right time, the same chemistry that the Saints have, we pray that our city will begin to have so that we could truly move forward.
Stephanie, the images are pretty amazing, and we haven't even had the big parade yet today. And, of course, a Super Bowl victory piled on top of Mardi Gras is something to contemplate.
It is.
But you write, and you remind us, you say it doesn't fill any potholes or rebuild any police stations or prevent senseless murders. This is not magic.
Of course not. And it's a moment when you feel like things are possible, though. And that, again, as Pastor Watson said, that's what I think people really want to hold on to. And, you know, these are not, for the most part, these are not, you know, big ego guys. I mean, really, not at all. Every single player you listen to understands what this means to the city. They have this incredible sense of humility and hard work and kind of defiance at being written off. So many of them were undrafted or drafted late or rejected by other teams because of injuries, and they really came back and felt like they had something to prove, and that really echoes what's going on in the city. And it's just kind of such a great fit spiritually for the city.
And Stephanie, remind us, right on, practically on top of this Super Bowl game in victory, you have had a mayoral election over this weekend on Saturday with a great big change coming as a result of that. Tell us about that election, who won, what it means.
Huge, for one thing. It was a huge margin of victory for Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, who has run for mayor before, most recently against Mayor Nagin 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, there are all sorts of different storylines. He'll be the first white mayor since the 70s. He put together really an extraordinary, for the city, biracial coalition. He won every precinct except one, and that one precinct he lost by one vote. So, I mean, talk about a mandate. And one of the things he really overcame, that I think the city really overcame, is this idea that we are divided by race. That is something that has often shaped our politics and really, unfortunately, has shaped our politics since Katrina. So I think there's a real hope there, too.
Jason Berry, what does it mean to you that Mitch Landrieu's coming in? I mean, the first white mayor since the 1970s, and his father, Moon Landrieu, who led the desegregation of City Hall there. Mayor Ray Nagin, known to the country and the world for the spotlight that fell on him in Hurricane Katrina. What does it mean that Mitch Landrieu's coming in?
Well, I think he's extremely capable, and he is very much in the vein of a coalition builder, you might even say a peacemaker. He's a solid guy. There's an interesting contrast between Mitch and Moon. When Moon was mayor in the 1970s, New Orleans had 12,000 employees in City Hall, and the city was riding a wave of federal dollars from Washington, D.C.
Mm.
By the time the next mayor, Dutch Morial was midway through his term in the late 1980s, the first African-American mayor. The revenue sharing had been drastically cut. President Reagan had declared the war on poverty was over and the famous, quote, poverty won. And over the next 20 years, we saw a substantial decline in federal support from Washington. And at the same time, there was an oil slump. We lost a large number of white-collar jobs. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, the crack epidemic hit. So the city has really been reeling in an economic sense, and with, you know, rising crime since then. And I think probably, in my own opinion, the greatest challenge we face is creating structures for at-risk youth so that we can begin to get a lot of these kids who are in terrible situations away from drugs, out of the lures of the underground economy, and into stable schools.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New Orleans, the city behind the Saints' Super Bowl victory, coming up on 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. We're joined by a great crew from New Orleans. Tom Watson, senior pastor at Watson Memorial Teaching Ministries, is with us. We talked with him when we were in New Orleans a couple years back, and very glad to have him with us today. Stephanie Grace is here, columnist for the Times-Picayune, joins us from New Orleans, as does Jason Berry, New Orleans author, historian, investigative reporter, author of Up from the Cradle of Jazz and Last of the Red Hot Papas. Stephanie, Jason, Tom, we've got a lot of callers right here. Let's bring a couple in. Jennifer in Dubuque, Iowa. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It sounds like I have a cold, but it's actually still my voice from screaming on Sunday.
Who are you screaming for, Jennifer?
The Saints, of course.
Okay.
I spent a lot of my childhood living in Algiers Point, which is right across the river from downtown New Orleans.
Yes.
And my oldest son was born in New Orleans. And I left in the 90s. And here I'm living up in the Midwest, and I just have to say I am so proud of the Saints. I've been a Saints fan for a very long time, and but you just when you've lived in New Orleans, and even if you haven't lived in New Orleans, you just feel like after the horrible pictures and the horrible things that we saw after Katrina,
mm-hmm.
that you really became a Saints fan, and this has been we've been praying for this for New Orleans for years, and for them to come basically out of nowhere and be able to beat some of the toughest quarterbacks.
Yep.
You know, Peyton
sure
Manning.
Did. Brett Favre, yeah.
What a sense of pride that we have, and I'm so proud of New Orleans for what they have done.
Jennifer, we hear it, and we hope you'll have a cup of tea for that voice and bring it back. But there's some cheer out, call out for New Orleans from Dubuque. Let me get one more, if I may. Lou in Boston. Lou, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually, my connection to New Orleans is my daughter, who moved down to New Orleans a little over a year ago to take part in the city's very vibrant art scene. And she had previously been in New Orleans shortly after Katrina, like so many young people, went down there to help out in the rebuilding activities. And she grew up in New England, in Boston area, and was a Patriots fan. And around the time of the Patriots-Saints game, when I sent her an email saying, go Pats, she wrote back, who dat?
She's gone native, Lou.
Yeah, right, exactly. It introduced me to the Who Dat Nation, who we promptly adopted shortly after our beloved Pats were thrown out.
And what's the word you get from her, Lou? It's a great victory. It's a great time of celebration. Is it a great time for the city of New Orleans, the real, you know, ground-level city? Is it back?
Well, you know, so I've been to New Orleans on and off for several years for business-related activities, and most recently we visited her down there. And I think for us as outsiders, we see a city that you know, has always been struggling and always looks somewhat disheveled. And the sort of the things that she has to address and her friends have to address, I think, are things that are so different than living in New England that we have to address. And the sort of difficulties, I think, are some things that she takes in stride. The sort of, I think she's lived in three or four different places in a year because of the difficulties of her landlord having been his mortgage was
he had financial problems with his property, and off she went to the next property.
She had to leave, and so I think the life in New Orleans is great, but it's also difficult. But she's given us faith and hope that that city is really on the rebound and is going to make it.
And maybe new faith and hope today. Lou, we appreciate your call as well. Tom Watson, let me come to you just for the big picture here. On the rebound, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, there was even talk of New Orleans more or less going away as a city. There might just be a little Disneyland chip left in the French Quarter and the rest kind of written off. How far back has the city come, Pastor Watson?
Well, and I'm glad you asked that question. Your caller that just hung up was right on it in terms of his daughter being here and experiencing the difficulties of not living in what I would call a full-service city. For instance, in the Lower Ninth Ward, it's still not come back. New Orleans East is struggling tremendously. When you think about over 100,000 people pre-Katrina living in New Orleans East, and I think there may be back to 50-60% of that number at this time, and there's still no full-service hospital. To me, it's the tale of maybe three cities where, as you mentioned, you know, right after Katrina, French Quarter, and even where my major church is located, we didn't get damaged. So we were able to recover a little bit more expediently than some other areas of town.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately, there's the good side of us being this sort of neighborhood city where we, you know, cling to our neighborhood roots and culturally we, you know, engage in our neighborhoods. But when you look at the big picture, I heard you use that term, mm-hmm. The big picture. The big picture to me is still very gloomy. You know, you can isolate yourself for only so long. I don't do a lot of traveling, but I do a moderate amount of
mm-hmm.
traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel the difference when you hit a full-service city. You can just feel it. Wow, everything is in place, you know, in terms of infrastructure and the like. So I would hope with the new mayor that he would really have an agenda to deal with what I want to call quality of life issues as it relates particularly to what we have in New Orleans as a permanent underclass. And I sponsored with two other pastors a major mayoral forum at Southern University the week or so before the election, and that was the one question that I asked all of the candidates for mayor, you know, what are you going to do about this permanent underclass? And it was the now Mary Leck who responded, Mitch Landrieu responded by saying it doesn't have to remain permanent.
Mm.
So now that he says he knows what to do and how to do it, I would pray that would be one of his main focuses, that we have a permanent underclass in this city, and I think Jason called it at-risk youth, and I've worked with that category for many, many years of not only my ministry but my professional life,
mm-hmm.
running a boys' home, running a young jail here, a youth jail here called the Youth Study Center. So I've done things in a lot of spectrums, so I would hope that big picture is inclusive of that permanent underclass, not for a handout. You know, I'm not suggesting that we look at the new mayor as a lot of people looked at President Obama. Here's a guy that's going to wave the magic wand and solve all our problems, but that there's true coalition building across our city at every strata, class, race, gender, mm-hmm. and the like, and truly build that spirit of gumbo that will turn this city around and help those who are least helpful of themselves to rise up to new dimensions. And because when the underclass rises, I think it impacts in a positive way everybody. It's a win-win, just like the Super Bowl was for the New Orleans Saints.
Spirit of gumbo, we got to check that out. Stephanie Grace, fill that picture on out for us. What's missing? You know, you live there every day. A lot of us don't have that same tangible sense of what's come back since Katrina.
Right.
What's there and what's not? What's missing from the picture in nuts and bolts terms? Hospital? missing?
Hospitals, absolutely. I mean, what Pastor Watson says is exactly right. It's, you know, you can be in one neighborhood and feel like you're living in a somewhat normal place. You can be in another neighborhood and feel like this happened, you know, a year ago, maybe.
Katrina, that is.
Katrina. And, you know, you go home at night and there aren't a lot of houses with lights on and, you know, you feel like you're in a little bit of an outpost. The area he mentioned, Eastern New Orleans, was, you know, 100,000 people. It was kind of the heart of the African-American middle class in the city before Katrina. There's no hospital there.
Was there one before Katrina?
There was
this
one before
charity
it was
hospital?
Flooded. No, that wasn't charity. That was Methodist.
Okay.
But the effect of that, you know, we have all these little chicken and egg questions around the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the population hasn't fully come back. Partly that's because there's no hospital. Older people, I think, feel like it's, you know, they're not comfortable being someplace where they can't get to a hospital quickly if they need to. So that's, you know, kind of hurt the population. It's, you know, which happens first? Do you build a hospital and then the people will come, or do you wait and see where the people are and then put the facilities in near them? That's been the question that's been asked over and over around the city. And it's been tough to deal with. It's happened with schools and police stations and all sorts of things.
Jason Berry, how would you describe, for those of us outside, looking in today to share New Orleans celebration, but looking bigger picture at the city itself, how would you describe what's happened since Katrina? What's happened and what hasn't?
Well, the last 4 years politically have been an outright disaster. Mayor Nagin, who worked very hard to get reelected and appealed to African-American voters, sometimes in very emotional terms, to give him a second term, then proceeded to squander the political capital he had. And it's been rather amazing to watch his level of detachment. He's at 20% now on his approval rating, and I think one of the reasons Mitch Landrieu got such a heavy base of African-American support in this election was precisely because people felt terribly disenchanted about Nagin. So leadership really does matter, especially when you have a broken city with profound infrastructure needs such as we have. One example, I spoke recently with a person who was formerly an official in the Commerce Department in Washington and explained that she'd had a conversation with Mayor Nagin and told him that funds were available, but the city did have to apply for those funds. He didn't do anything. She bumped into him later on, and he said, well, it's not on our agenda right now. If you don't go after money everywhere it's available when you've got a city on its knees, you're not doing your job.
Jason, what do you mean when you say broken city exactly? It may be obvious to you being there, but less obvious to some of our listeners who are not.
Well, I could put it this way. The miles and miles and miles of streets that have deep crevices and scars are just a reality. They're ubiquitous. From where I live to drive to the supermarket where I go, I have to make a detour to go down the one street that is well-paved, that's a straight shot from Claiborne Avenue on State Street down to Chapultepec so I can get to the Winn-Dixie supermarket. There are four or five other streets going in that direction that I don't take because I want to preserve my tires as best I can. That's a small example. The sewage, or I should say the piping system, the Sewage and Water Board, had profound needs before the storm, and we know there's a tremendous amount of subsurface leaking going on. These are major capital projects. I mean, how do you do it? Do you do a bond issue and pass it on to the next generation? Do you get help from Baton Rouge and New Orleans and Washington? I don't know all the answers, but I think everyone feels confident that we have a mayor-elect who at least knows how to make the pieces come together.
There was a lot of commentary during Katrina that what we saw on the television was an unacknowledged third-world city in America, the level of distress. Does that label fit, Jason, or way beyond that?
So. Yeah, sure. No, I would agree with that. And I, look, I'm a native son, and I don't like admitting that. But politically, it was really a failed place for all kinds of reasons, and I hate to say this, but one of the biggest drawbacks we had was the machine of Congressman Jefferson, who was an immensely talented man.
The now indicted U.S. congressman, you know, with the cash convicted in the freezer.
The way he's now
convicted. Excuse me, of course.
And,
yeah.
And his brother has been convicted, and one of the sisters is going to stand trial. He created a political machine that really used the public school administration as a spoil system. And, you know, that may have worked in Chicago in the 1950s when it was a big enough city so that a little corruption didn't hurt the momentum of urban growth. But this is a small city.
Not New Orleans, not now. Let's get some calls in here. Chris in Andover, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had the privilege of visiting New Orleans in April following Katrina. And it was quite an experience, as you can imagine.
Mm.
And I heard one of your guests before speaking about the dirty water line that you see. And that was one of the most striking experiences I can ever remember.
Leftover from Katrina and the flooding that it brought.
Yes, exactly. I actually wrote a song called Waterline based on my experiences there because it kind of describes the whole experience of the city as you drive down one of the streets and see this water line that's 7 feet above the ground.
Yeah,
I had the privilege of being of visiting some of the public schools while I was there at that time, and this group of very dedicated people had put back together this very important function for the children in that city. And I think that I just heard your guest speaking about the corruption in the public school system, and I think it's really unfortunate because the people that I met were very dedicated, and I know that there are a lot of charter schools in New Orleans now, but I'm very concerned about the public school system and how that serves the city.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for your comment. That public school system and what Reverend Tom Watson called the permanent underclass. Stephanie, we just got a few seconds before the break. What portion of New Orleans' population did not come back after so many were dispersed in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina?
Well, there's actually a lot of debate over the population, and it's a politically loaded question because we have the census coming up, and a lot of money hinges on what the population count would be. The estimates at this point range from down, it was 462,000 before Katrina,
mm-hmm.
could be 350, could be less. It's a significant hit, but the population is growing, so that's on the upside.
Growing, but a lot of people still sitting outside the city have not come back.
A lot of people are waiting to see what's going to happen. You know, do I have something to come back to? Or am I better off where, you know, a lot of people, as some of your other guests have said, a lot of people had never lived in a really functional place until they got evacuated. And, you know, some people liked it, I have to say, and are coming back with higher expectations or looking to New Orleans with higher expectations.
Or maybe not back yet. Stephanie Grace with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Jason Berry, Reverend Tom Watson, please stand by there. We're looking at New Orleans, the city behind the Saints Super Bowl victory. Starting in April, HBO will be airing a new drama about New Orleans called Tremé. It's from David Simon, creator of the hit series The Wire. Here's a little bit of the theme there. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
To know we're coming in peace and love from Congo Square. Oh, peace. Peace. I said it down on the bayou where the river flows.
Peace, peace,
oh, peace,
of mind.
I said, I like once the train go for Mexico.
Peace, oh, peace, oh, peace of mind.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New Orleans, the city behind the Saints Super Bowl victory, coming up on 5 years this August after Hurricane Katrina. Joined this hour from New Orleans by Tom Watson, senior pastor at the Watson Memorial Teaching Ministries. Stephanie Grace, columnist for the Times-Picayune, is with us. And Jason Berry, New Orleans author, historian, is with us. Here's a little tape of the mayor-elect of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu. Now, this is the son of Moon Landrieu, who was the last white mayor of New Orleans. He is, of course, also the brother of Mary Landrieu, Democratic U.S. Senator from Louisiana. He'll be the first white mayor since his father left office. The new mayor-elect was asked about race on the night of his election. Here he is on New Orleans WDSU-TV.
I don't see myself as a white mayor. I see myself as a kid from the 13th Ward who just got elected mayor by the largest crossover vote in the history of the city. And I'm here to represent everybody. And I've said very forcefully on the campaign trail, people who said that race is not an issue in this city are either blind or deaf. It is an issue. But the thing here is you can't go around it. You can't go over it. You have to go through it. We have to deal with it. And it seems as though the people of the city of New Orleans took a huge leap forward today by saying that, look, we actually have significant common ground.
Pastor Tom Watson, in New Orleans, you've run for mayor. You must know this man. He's run before and been around New Orleans for a long time. What do you think this election says about where New Orleans race relations are going?
Well, it's interesting. I ran actually with Mitch back in 06 when, you know, mm-hmm. we were trying to unseat Nagin. So I am pretty close to the process and understanding a little bit in terms of what some of this means. I don't know what it means when Mitch says he doesn't see himself as a white mayor. And I think he's trying to look at the big picture, but you can't deny who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. I am a black pastor, and when I get up, I can't say I'm not a black pastor. I am a black pastor.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, he's a very savvy guy politically, and I think he's – I'm not trying to take a shot at the Mary Lick at all. That is not my intent. But
he's trying to build a bridge there.
Excuse me?
He's trying to build a bridge there, presumably.
Exactly, and I understand that, but in the same breath, he came back to say – that we must deal with it. We must. It is an issue, and I do think that if he is the kind of guy to build coalitions, and I think he has a proven record of doing some of that in our city and in our state, that maybe he is the guy that, based upon his message, you know, he knows what to do, and he knows how to do it. Now, that's sort of, again, that big picture you mentioned a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
The key is, how do you take that big picture and roll it out in some strategic ways that will really, after 4 years or 8 years or however long he's in office, really would have made an impact? I mean, I don't look to the mayor to do the resolve of everything. I mean, I mm-hmm. look to the mayor to be a partner. And that's what I have done with all of the mayors that I've tried to work with, even as I worked for city government for 13 years. So it's about partnerships. It's about facing reality. And it is a massive job, and I would hope that people don't have all of this unexpected kind of goals and sort of, if you will, things that this guy will do to turn the city around.
Tom, some people say that one of the big results of Hurricane Katrina was to change the racial complexion of New Orleans, that a lot of those who were kind of swept away by the storm and now displaced outside the city were what constituted part of that black underclass you talked about earlier. How big a change has come from that, losing, what, a quarter of the population?
Yeah, but what's your specific question? Because I don't think race relations improved a whole lot since the storm. I'm just being frank.
I think
there's been more divisiveness since the storm. I think that there was and there still is a sort of group of persons in this city that still do not want the entire city to come back. And let's be honest,
mm-hmm.
I mean, 2 days after the storm, my custodian remained. He slept overnight in the church. And he said that there were people dancing in the streets hoping that some of us would not come back to the city. And, of course, they were mainly speaking about African-Americans.
Mm.
Then there was the study that was done. I forget which group out of Washington, the land group.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think of it right now. But anyway, that declared that, you know, we should, you know, shut off certain parts of the city. That mindset, we have to be honest, is somewhat still out there, because here we are almost 5 years down the road. And as we said earlier, you have segments of this city that do look like a third world country. I personally walked through Girktown fully twice. My son ran for city council. I walked with him through parts of the district in a section called Girktown. If you don't know what that is, it's just a stone's throw from the infamous Xavier University.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would walk through that city, I mean, through that part of the city, it will sadden you. I mean, it's almost hidden. It's almost isolated. And to me, we have the capacity, I believe, right now to make Girktown liken unto Georgetown in Washington, D.C. You got a big, beautiful university that's very, you know, robust and prospering.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a stone's throw away, a neighborhood that looks like a third world village. And so my point is that since the storm, we have had some great things to happen. So I don't want to say that we have not had great things to happen, and we were experiencing that right now with the Saints. But at the in the same breath, you know, there are segments of our community that are still struggling. And when you talk about people in the diaspora, I heard Jason talk about streets as a sort of small example of the struggle we have here. But what about blight? What about housing? There are people who cannot come back, not because they're sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what's going to happen. They're sitting on the sidelines, and some of them can't get a Greyhound bus ticket back to New Orleans still 5 years after the storm. Some of them cannot get a Section 8 voucher to get a decent place to live. And if they can get back to the city, because of the permanent underclass and the economic situation and the quality of life here, they cannot even afford the rent in this city. So, I mean, there are many, many issues that a new mayor and a new city council are going to have to confront. And I make a statement all the time where there's no confrontation, there's no resolution. So I hope in what the mayor-elect just said that he's going to confront those issues, that we will see that kind of strategy taking place.
Let's hear from some of that diaspora, if we may. Bobby in Omaha, Nebraska. Bobby, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
And I just want to second what was just said. I'm the director for the Katrina survivors in Nebraska. I stayed in the city for 11 days after the storm, and there were 176 of us airlifted to Omaha. Here, I have many people right now who are trying to get back to the city, and because they can't find affordable housing before they get there, because they don't have the money here to get back on their own, there are no agencies out here that's providing transportation or assistance for the people from Katrina to get back to New Orleans. We've been struggling out here. I mean, you can imagine that right now it's 10 degrees in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah.
For a lot of my people, I mean, that means isolation for them because they've never been exposed to this kind of temperature.
Do you feel abandoned outside of New Orleans, Bobby? Do you feel like you were sort of airlifted out and, you know, off you go, left on your
own? I mean, by force. We wanted to stay, and the vast majority of us wanted to stay in the city and help rebuild the city. And we were forced out of the city and have been abandoned by the city, by the state, and just don't know what to do. And so, you know, for people like us, those of us who literally long to get back to the city, you know, I mean, there's just no, and particularly the Red Cross. I've been extremely disappointed with working through the Red Cross and trying to get assistance for my people to get back to New Orleans.
But it hasn't happened, and it's going on 5 years now. Bobby, thanks for your call. Stephanie Grace, how can it be that there's an affordable housing problem in New Orleans? You would think by description that there's a lot of housing that you couldn't charge that much for. It may not be very good, but you'd think it'd be affordable.
Well, you know, there is available housing, but there's, you know, it's kind of out of kilter, as people have said, with the ability to pay of a lot of people who want to come back. I mean, there actually have been some new complexes that have gone up. Some of the big public housing complexes have been torn down. That was a controversial thing that happened a few years ago, and they're being rebuilt right now, so they are going to be coming online pretty soon. You know, it's just kind of a system that's broken, I guess, and an economy that's broken, and there's no one answer. There's a tremendous amount of blighted housing. There isn't a lot of money to fix these places up. We've run right into the national recession, so money that probably would have been available a few years ago is not available now. It's, you know, and there's kind of no guiding hand trying to match the population to the housing, and it's been a bit of a free-for-all in ways, you know, that's provided a tremendous opportunity for people who are entrepreneurial and can figure out what to do with themselves and have the resources to do it themselves, but it's left a lot of people really just, I think, feeling abandoned, feeling like, you know, I don't know what to do and I don't know where to go for help. And it's, you know, it's a tremendous problem. And I, you know, the mayor can only kind of start to chip away at it.
Let's get a call from Kate in Leicester, Vermont. Kate, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I called because I really think that it's a very simple thing. Effect the Saints have had on people, and they've been having that effect for a while, but I think some other things have been having that effect. And I think it's about leadership. I think New Orleans and the state as a whole has lacked good leadership for so long. And firstly, I think the last good leader we had in New Orleans was probably Dutch Moria. And since then, it's not been strong. And to see what leadership can do in terms of getting people to work together, and these were not people that anyone would have said were the most talented or the most, you know, likely to succeed, but putting them together with good leadership made a huge difference. And I think that's kind of translated into the political arena, and I think the voting in the last election had a lot to do with people's leadership. I lived in New Orleans until Katrina. I happened to be in Vermont when Katrina happened and kind of hosted the people who came up here to stay for a couple of months. My daughter went back to reopen our business, which is a bar in the Lower Garden District. You know, we had Wi-Fi, so people could set up their offices there. This was in the very beginning of October, after Katrina. In fact, we had a Super Bowl party that was also for the to benefit Doctors Without Borders in Haiti. And I think what I've seen, and it's been going on for a long time in New Orleans since Katrina, is bit by bit, the people have come back. They finally figured out nobody is going to help us. We're going to have to do it ourselves. And the little bit of help that, or the big amounts of help that supposedly Road Home represented, ended up helping people in Ninth Ward not at all. And, you know, people that I know who had minimal damage to expensive houses got huge amounts of money. I mean, it was just administered. And I don't think by plan. It was just administered in a totally goofy way, you know. So I think what we see now happening is people finally recognizing we had terrible problems before Katrina. Katrina didn't create this. We were the only southern city that I think had a net population loss every year, you know, for example. We had terrible schools. We were the murder capital of the nation several years before Katrina. You know, this wasn't created by Katrina. This was created by a lot of other problems. And I think it was lack of leadership across the board, not just political leadership. I think we had a lack of economic leadership from our elite in the city. We have a very strong class system there, which is gradually breaking down, but not quickly. You know,
right. So, they weren't new problems, but they were sure stripped bare by the hurricane. Kate, that's a lot of insight in just a minute and a half. We appreciate it. Thanks for your call. Jason, sorry.
I just wanted to echo something that Pastor Watson said about, you know, people celebrating, if you will, the loss of so many poor folk. He's absolutely right. It was appalling, the political sensibility that emerged after the hurricane, and the Urban Land Institute with its plan for the smaller footprint that simply wrote off all these neighborhoods. It was class politics really at its most, just at its most venal, in my view. But and what your caller just said, I would certainly agree with about the poor leadership prior to that. But not to honeycoat any of this, I do think we are at a turning point. And Landrieu made a very important point in one of the debates. He was running against several people, one guy in particular who's a very wealthy, successful businessman, who said, "I will bring, you know, business skills to City Hall if you elect me." And he said, "We don't need business skills in City Hall. We need a public servant who knows what to do." And I think so much of the vote he got reflected a view really across the society that leadership does matter, and you need someone in office who knows how to put the pieces together. As Stephanie put it, to have that guiding hand to match the needs with the resources. So I think that's where the optimism comes from, and I don't think any of the three of us you know, on the program today are cockeyed optimists about where we're going, but it is a moment of hope, and that part feels good.
No Pollyannas, but yep, there's a good ripple right there. Stephanie here from Facebook. Jeff is asking, and I'm sure many people are thinking this, how will New Orleans fare next time a Category 5 hurricane hits? Have adjustments been made, he asks, for those living in low-lying areas? Can the levees and water removal system handle a future Katrina? Stephanie?
Well, we should at first point out that Katrina was not a Category 5 storm, so
right.
Category 5 would be much worse. Slowly, you know, the levee system is kind of piecemeal. It's not one system, it's many systems, and, you know, the city and the state and the federal government are slowly working through it. It's not happening nearly as quickly as most people would like, but it's starting to happen. Certain things were done to protect the heart of the city, which is more easy to protect, which is easier to protect than some of the outlying areas. There are you know, we've actually had an evacuation since Katrina. It went pretty well. The storm ended up missing us. But, you know, there are now buses. They made all sorts of things people didn't really understand would be issues before Katrina. Pets. They've now come up with a system to evacuate people's pets. Now, you could say that's not the most important thing you have to worry about people. But what happened is people wouldn't leave their pets.
And what about the water itself? Because the word after Katrina was the, you know, civil engineers had left it just lying there, the city, vulnerable. Is it still vulnerable?
It is vulnerable. It's getting better slowly. One thing that the state has made a tremendous push on and is really looking for federal help on is rebuilding the wetlands outside of New Orleans, which can act as a hurricane buffer, can absorb a lot of the storm surge. So it's a very long-term environment engineering issue, but we're working on it.
Well, we are very glad to catch up with you all there at a time when the city is celebrating. We hope you get a bit of the parade today and enjoy Mardi Gras to come and find some real rebuilding in the months and years ahead. Stephanie Grace at the Times-Picayune, Jason Berry, author of Up from the Cradle of Jazz, and Reverend Tom Watson at Watson Memorial Teaching Ministries, all in New Orleans. Our thanks to each of you for being with us this hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.